We're about to start the Portuguese Grand Prix. The final race of the season is underway. Good start from Morbidelli. Really good start also from Miguel Oliveira from pole position, who immediately goes over to try and defend turn one.
Hello and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 652. I am one of your hosts, Skyler Vicori, and joining me as ever is Jim McDowell. Jim, how's it going?
Getting ready for Turkey Day, my friend. It's U.S. Thanksgiving here tomorrow. It's a cooking craze. Everybody decides that they want to cook for one day out of the year. But I spent most of the day today in the garage putting new shelving up, rearranging motorcycles and parts and getting things like that together. So it's the off season. What else are you going to do?
I wish I was kind of doing that today. I spent most of my day after because I just got back from our baby moon last night at around about 10 o'clock and then been up since the sun came up this morning and been running around from meanwhile the wife's been cooking, you know, 8 or 9 dishes or prepping them or as much as she can, and I've been flying around picking up missed items at grocery stores that don't have the item that I gotta go to the next one and make an appointment over here to get this. And so
legally allowed to have as many people as you're gonna have at your facility?
We're not actually having that many folks. They got scaled back, but we are making food for people to drop off to them.
Nice.
Because a lot of my family members are law enforcement, so they're working. And so we'll be dropping food down at the station to them. And then we have some neighbors we'll be dropping some food off to. And then I know I got some friends whose family moves out of town, so they'll probably snag a plate. So we make quite a bit of food. Because at the very worst, you have leftovers, and I love me some Thanksgiving leftovers.
Okay, maybe you do, but man, that's one of my I hate Thanksgiving leftovers. It just doesn't work for me. Sorry, folks, it is not a part of my game plan. But it could have been because as a kid, my family was only 3 people: my mom, my dad, and me. And so, like, my dad's boss tried to be a nice guy, and he'd buy everybody a turkey for Thanksgiving, which I, you know, that's cool, right? Well, here we are coming home with a 25-pound bird for 3 people. So I'm mauling on turkey for, like, Thanksgiving, the day after Thanksgiving, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, next Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. So I'm kind of just done with it. But anyway, man, we're not here to talk about food. This is not a cooking show, man. Let's talk about racing, man. We're at Portimão. I think everybody wants to know about what happened in Portimão.
Yes, but before we do, Jim, we've got to get the show started proper, and it's definitely the holiday season, so.
That sounded weak.
Well, it's because this is a low carbonation. This is a stout, so it's not going to have that nice crisp pop. But we're starting to get into my favorite time of the year. We're getting close to the winter ales and stouts and all the darks and seasonal beers. This is the time of the year where, I mean, you can always drink for effect. I try not to.
I drink to forget that I have in-laws.
Okay? Yeah, but I love the taste of these beers. I don't have to have too many, and most of these are pretty heavy, so they either put you to sleep or put you out one way or the other.
Either way, you're gonna be done at the end of this podcast.
Yeah, probably. So this is from High Water Brewing. This is called their Campfire Stout, and it has a very— I've had this before, but it's very flavorful. It kind of does have that smoky taste to it. But it's very smooth. But this isn't too bad. This is 6.5%, and that's not bad for a stout. Some of these bad boys
get up there like 12, 13.
Yeah. Those ones, I get one of those going on the show, and everybody will know real quick. All right. Well, now we can get the show started because I've had my first sip. One of it probably at least 20 as we get going here. But yeah, Jim, you know, we did have— I mean, it's been a busy season, and we're getting to our last round, and it seems like a lot of our listeners— I mean, this is the most listener feedback we've had for quite some time.
Yeah, we're doing something right or wrong. Take your pick.
Right? But it is nice to kind of see, like, hey, we have been, you know, asking for people to write in, and here we go. So why don't you go ahead and take us with the first one there, Jim?
Yeah, grab this one here. So this comes from Michael McDonald. He says, Skyler and Jim, just to provide some insight into the news of GasGas joining Moto3 Paddock, the bike is an RC250 GP in red white livery, much like the Husky Moto3 machines are the same as the RC250 GP in white, blue, yellow livery. KTM acquired a controlling share, 65% of GasGas in 2019, purchasing the shares from Spain and a Spanish federal trust, as the company was in receivership and had been supported by Spanish Treasury since 2017. The acquisition created some controversy and animosity among Spanish moto fans due to the concerns of the behemoth KTM consuming a Spanish entity and moving jobs out of the country. Pierre, KTM CEO, has stated at least one of the two fractures would be retained, but the lineup would be updated with KTM technology. The 20 lineups were unchanged, but 21 bikes are now mostly KTM designs and components. The bikes are all produced in, hopefully this is right, Genoa, Spain, with KTM retooling the former primary factory. This may have been done for tax purposes, as all management and operations has been moved to Matagalpan, home of KTM AG. So, Michael, thank you for that. I did not know at the time, call it poor footwork and homework on my part, but the news of this announcement had just broken on MotoGP. I read it quickly before the show and did not have any idea that KTM owned GasGas, but of course the next day when I wake up and I read a few more articles on it, yeah, I find out that. So mea culpa, my bad, should have put a little bit more study into it, but thank you for throwing out the details there for us. And so everyone now knows that KTM owns GasGas, and that's how they wound up with another motorcycle. So it's really just going to be KTM versus Honda again next year, which, different paint. Anyway, whatever. But that's the first part of it. The second part of Michael's email is more interesting. I think you'll have something to say on this, Skylar. I'm pretty sure it says, on a less technical note, interested in listening to your thoughts, filling that RSGP seat. Not surprised that Cal and Dovi declined given Poggio's financial issues. Bezzecchi declining? Cannot recall the last time a Moto2 rider declined the opportunity to advance to GP. Is that a statement on how little respect his advisors have for Aprilia or further sign VR46 is going to GP in full force in 22 and Bezzecchi has a guaranteed seat? Roberts and Canet. Perhaps more indicative of Aprilia's budget, I'm a fan of Joe, but is that a good move for him as opposed to a Taltrans Moto2? Is the best option in Moto2 paddocked if you're Aprilia? I personally would choose Remy over Joe and wouldn't consider Canet a top five candidate. That guy hasn't shown any ability to keep rubber side down in either Moto2 or Moto3. Keep up the good work, Michael McDonald. Well, Michael, we had a bit of a back and forth with this, but I want your take on this, Skylar. What do you think about that whole Joe Roberts Aprilia thing?
It kind of bleeds into some of the news that we will bring up, so we might as well just talk about it now. It made a lot of, over the last weekend, it gained quite a bit of traction, and there seemed to be a lot of smoke and perhaps a fire, but in the end, it all just kind of settled out, and they're going to be moving on forward with Bradley Smith and Lorenzo Salvadori. But this is the thing I was, kind of when I said I was talking out of both sides of my mouth, where, you really don't want to turn down a MotoGP contract, but talk to Sam Lowes. He did this Aprilia thing. Is this the team you want to go to start your MotoGP career? Because you can get lost in it real quick. If the bike and the team isn't there, and you're looked at as the person that's failing, right? Look at Sam Lowes kind of had to dredge himself through. He goes back to Moto2, and he's kind of rebuilding himself, right? I mean, if Sam goes through next year and has a, he starts the season off where he left it off this year, minus the injuries, of course, and he does really well, it'd be hard not to try to give him another swing at MotoGP because you can see the skill is still there. So I think there probably is. I wouldn't say Bezzecchi has a guaranteed seat or the VR46 team is a guaranteed team, but they have the luxury. Him and Joe Roberts do have, and Aaron Canet as well. They're all young guys, so they have the luxury of time to make this decision. So if they're kind of looking at MotoGP, and okay, there's probably going to be another seat or two. There's going to be some shifting. There's a lot of big contracts, not necessarily this year, but next year there'll be a lot of movement going around in GP, so maybe teams will want to take a flyer on someone in Moto2 as well. It's probably setting yourself up a bit better to get into perhaps a more suitable or stable team in 22 rather than jumping at, this leftover seat that, they weren't really planning for you. It's not designed for you. It's, well, our options are gone, so can you come ride this bike now? And I could see why riders would be certainly wary of taking this seat, And then, you know, Aleix Espargaró, he hasn't made himself look like the easiest teammate to have as well with some of the comments he's made recently about either younger or older teammates. But yeah, I'm not surprised they've turned the seat down, but it had to be a hard decision.
Yeah, I think you're damned if you do, damned if you don't with Aprilia here. That's where I'm at. If you, like you said before, Skylar, if you go there and you do really well, it's because Aprilia did something to the bike. If you go there and you look like crap, it's you, not the bike. So for me, I think Joe Roberts is a guy who has to prove himself. He's had some flashes of brilliance, but he hasn't won yet. Now, if you go back to the whole thing, and probably the only time I've ever really been right, when Patrona Sprinta was looking for a guy to put on their MotoGP bike, I said, well, I'd take Quartararo. Now, this was fresh after Quartararo had won the Spanish GP at Barcelona, but Quartararo had showed that he had some real talent. He won when he needed to. Now, Roberts hasn't done that. Now, he's had poles. He's been close to the front. He does show flashes of brilliance, but I think next year on a Taltrans is Roberts' make-or-break year. He has to be consistent at all the tracks, not just his favorite tracks. He has to be at the front. He has to be challenging for wins and podiums consistently. And if he doesn't do that, I don't think he has a lot left. You know, I don't know where he could go. So I think it's a make or break. So definitely, I think better that he stay on a Moto2 bike that he knows and go to the Aprilia and try to work through that. And that would just be an absolute nightmare for him. So that's kind of where I stand on it.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to have to wait and see. I think in the end, this is probably the best decision that Aprilia, I mean, outside of maybe grabbing Chaz Davies to have that experience in your team. But they already, you know, these guys know the bike, another year of development, and now they can wait to the whole 2022 shakeup as well, and they may be able to snag a bit rider, you know, a little more advanced rider. But this is also when we talked about, you know, Dovizioso declining it. It's like, hey, dude, I know you say you're taking a sabbatical, but the circus is going on without you, and there's a lot of talent coming up, and let's see, do we want your heavy contract with you on the other side of the hill, or do we want to take a lighter contract with someone who has nothing but upside? Ooh, kind of good luck getting back in the paddock, bud.
Yeah, agreed. All right, should we go on to the second bit of listener feedback?
Yeah, sure. I'll take this one. I'll give you a rest here.
Thank you.
So this comes from Lee. He says, hey, fellas, I've been a longtime listener since the days of MotoGP OD. Yep, that is a long time ago. This podcast got me through the beginning when I wasn't well off enough to afford the video pass subscription. Been there as well. Thanks, and you guys have done a great job cultivating and stewarding the podcast. Love all the talk about MotoGP as well as the other series and off-topic stuff. Oh, very nice, very nice. Thank you, thank you.
He probably likes your beer reviews.
Possibly. Anyway, I'm writing about Portugal. It dawned on me that this round is comparable to an all-star event like we have in American sports and should be fine more often. And it would even help validate Valencia. Hear me out. I know traditionally Valencia is the final round. The downside of this is that the points-based nature of the series meant it usually isn't that important of a round. I was stationed in Germany and was fortunate enough to attend the Valencia round in 13 or 14, memory sleeping, when all three classes were still undecided. It was a big deal because it had been some time since that had happened. Adding an exhibition round at the end would help shift the points total towards Valencia. Calling it an exhibition probably wouldn't be favorable, but all the same. Awarding points through it would still have the same effect. What makes the idea special, though, is it doesn't have to be the same track every year. They could showcase a safe and suitable, of course, track that isn't usually visited. I think it was an exciting proposition having a track that was unknown, a wild card, if you will. Cost being a limiting factor, there probably wouldn't be any flyaways, so no Barber, Indy, Laguna Seca, etc. But I'm sure there are some wonderful tracks in Europe that aren't used. Like Miller said, it's nice to end somewhere not cold. Bringing the show to other locales could also increase fan base, especially if it's the home of a country or someone other than Italian, Spanish. Just a thought. Again, great work on the show, Lee. Lee, thank you for writing in. Thank you for all the compliments. I'm glad you've stuck around. You've probably heard, I guess, if you've been around since MotoGP OD, you've heard just about all the hosts come through. So vary the show. But yes, I agree. I think having some sort of I talked to my buddy about this the other day, Jim, because F1 did the same thing this year. We got all these tracks we don't normally go to. I said, would it be cool if you could do, you had every year 15, so let's say you had a 20 race schedule.
Okay.
15 of those races, you lock into long-term contracts with 5 rotating spots. Those 5 rotating spots, each year you get a different track, but it's in the same pool. Like, you would know what the tracks are, but those tracks get rotated in, right? So those 10 or 15 tracks that maybe can't sustain a race every year or afford to do a race every year, because it does cost a lot to bring the circus to town, and then you kind of bring those in, and you have variables made with those weekends. I believe that would make things quite interesting. It kind of goes along with the whole wild card exhibition race idea here that Lee brought in his email.
Yep. Since you said you were stationed in Germany, I'm going to go out on a limb and think that you are a veteran. So, sir, thank you very much for your service. When I first read it, the first thing that shot to my mind was he was thinking along the lines of the old Easter Sunday tradition of the match races between the United States and Great Britain. And I got to thinking, like, maybe that would be sort of where he was. And then, you know, then it kind of sounded like it was going into this whole idea of, hey, rotate a track in and out. And I'm thinking, you know, that's not a bad idea, because there's some places I think we could go with MotoGP bikes that are probably safe enough. I think you could go to the Nürburgring in Germany, not the old Nordschleife, the new one, of course. That would be kind of interesting, but it's Germany, so you couldn't do it at the end of the year. So, again, it'd be sort of that in and out kind of a thing when you're doing it. Then I thought, well, we haven't been to Magny Cours, so that might be kind of interesting to do. I think we could go to, like, the Circuit Paul Ricard in the south of France, which would be warm, right? That, you know, it's the high-tech test track, and there's no stands, and there's some for the Formula One cars when they're there. But that'd be kind of interesting, but I don't know how a GP bike would work there with all the lines, and half the time I get seasick if I watch that F1 race there. But I like his idea. I mean, I really do. There, it's sort of a something special kind of a thing that you look forward to. You know, as much as most people want to knock me over the head when I make this comparison, I'll do it anyway. It's kind of like the Winston All-Star race at Charlotte for NASCAR, right? Or like what it used to be, for God's sakes, it used to be the Bud Shootout for all the pole winners at Daytona before the Daytona 500 every year, where it was just a go-for-broke race and you had a large sum of money to win and, you know, no points. So I think it's a neat idea. I mean, for me, I believe that Portugal should have a lifetime contract to host MotoGP there. I just think the track is fantastic. And I think some of the people talking about the fact that we couldn't pass at Portugal was a little bit unfounded, because I think these guys found some places to pass. And I thought the racing was quite good. But I like the idea. I'm not sure I don't think the factories are going to let their guys do that. I don't think the sponsors are going to like it, because who wants to see, you know, somebody, call it any story you want, Marc Marquez, Alex Rins, Quartararo, get hurt in a quote-unquote exhibition race, or some race that doesn't account for any points in the championship. So if you're going to do it, it's going to have to be a rotate-in track, which would be cool, because it does produce one track that you haven't been to, say, in 5 years, so things are going to be different. I mean, you could throw Turkey in there. I think when we raced there, oh gosh, when was that, 2005, 6, 7, something around there? I thought Turkey was a great track for the bikes, too. So I love it. I just don't think it's going to happen, but I like it.
Yeah, Turkey is a wonderful track. I think something happened financially with them, because they lost MotoGP and F1, and then I think it got turned.
Well, they somehow got the money back, because Formula One came calling and said, hey, can we use your racetrack this year? And that whole thing got repaved, and it was like the pavement had only just gotten down before the F1 cars got there, which made it for a crazy race. But yeah, there's something there. I'm not sure what. I was trying to think. You know, there's other tracks in the Middle East that we could go to with bikes. Like, we could maybe go to Bahrain.
Come on.
Okay, Bahrain is only boring because you got a Formula One car with aerodynamics that nobody can pass. All right. If you ran the whole long loop track, which has a couple pretty good corners in it for a motorcycle, I think. I haven't, you know, just if I look at the track map and I see the onboards from the cars, I think, ooh, this might be kind of cool for a motorcycle. I think you could maybe do that because it would be completely different, right? And you're only going to see it like once every 5 years because, like you say, well, you got Nürburgring, Turkey, Portimao, Bahrain, which is not too far away. You could, you know, maybe Paul Ricard. There's your five tracks, or Magny Cours, right? There's five tracks and you're running them in and out. Don't know. Anyway, just thoughts. Just thoughts. It's a good thought experiment. I like it.
I like it too. And I like the fact that we're getting this listener feedback. So remember, folks, if you want to write us in, just like these fine gentlemen did, you can go ahead and send it into motopod@motopodcast.com. That goes to all the hosts. We'll either go ahead and have a nice response within the email from any of the hosts, or we might throw it on the show here if we think it's going to be a good topic to kind of get going with. Either way, we do enjoy it. Please do keep sending it in. And remember, it could be about the racing. It could be about just any bikes. It doesn't even have to be about bikes. You want to argue with us? You want to agree with us? We don't care. You want to talk about beer? It doesn't matter. Remember, this show is for all of you. So if you want to talk about something, we're more than happy to do it. So shoot us an email when you get the chance. All right, Jim. That brings us into the news. And the first bit of news we did already cover, and that was basically that Aprilia is going to go ahead and move forward with Aleix Espargaró, Lorenzo Salvadori, and Bradley Smith for the 2021 lineup. And after preseason testing, the final decision made on who will be there to, well, who's going to ride alongside Aleix Espargaró. Let's get that right.
Let's be real about that one.
Yeah, unless Aleix has been dining at the same.
I think the money's on Bradley Smith, to be honest with you.
I mean, yeah. I mean, it should. I think it will be too.
I wish they had Chaz there, to change it up.
But. I did too, just to see. I think Chaz could, you know, offer a lot of insight.
I think Chaz has got some good bike development stuff, right? He was riding the Panigale when it first came out, and they had to do a lot of work to make that bike work. So I think he's probably better suited for what Aprilia needs to do, but they didn't choose that. So,
I mean,
that whatever.
That was a tough one too, because Chaz, I think he's sunsetting his career now as well.
Yeah.
We've seen World Superbike, he hasn't been the same, especially because it was like, okay, is the bike bad? And then he's had Bautista and now Scott Redding jump into that team and just kind of trounce him, right? Through both seasons.
Yep.
So, yeah. Bike development, maybe. But then they're probably looking at, you know, of course, any sport you ever do, it's all about what have you done for me lately, no matter the body of work, right? That's all fans look at. It happens. It's a human thing. So they might have been looking at that and said, Chaz, I mean, thanks, but we're going to move on with what we got here at the very least. So, or maybe his contract was too much. Who knows?
Who knows?
Anyway. All right.
All that means is that the Joe Roberts talk, which was so much smoke, but just didn't have any fire.
Yeah, and that was weird,
that's
right?
Weird.
Because he's already locked into a contract. Oh, and that was something else that they had talked about. I think it was, I might have been reading it on crash.net. I should check my source on this one, but I believe it was there where they had mentioned, or maybe they interviewed somebody, memory slipping. That was a few beers ago this week. I was at San Diego Breweries, excuse me. But anyway, they mentioned that, you know, they couldn't get riders out of Moto2, and then because some had contracts for next year already, and it's like, all right. So I'm kind of wondering if they may have gone with one of those Moto2 riders as well, but the buyout was too much because I can imagine a team like Iltel Trans is like, listen, we'll let go of Joe, but here's the thing: it's way late in the game for us to get a rider of this caliber on this team because everybody's already locked down. So we need a significant amount of money to walk away from this contract, and Aprilia was probably like, we'll give you $5 because that's all we got in the bank right now. This player, like, all right, well, no thanks.
We'll pay you in lira.
Yeah. It's like, I mean, no, it's not going to happen. So that might have something to do with Joe not making over there because it was almost like publicity. Like, was this leaked out from his team management just to get his name and excitement and like Roberts to GP? Was this a passport move? Like, we got to have an American in MotoGP, so let's try to get him in there. I don't know. Strange one, but it was fun.
Is what it is.
For a weekend, I guess.
Yeah. All right. So next thing in the news, this involves Formula One star Max Verstappen. He says that he loves the competitive nature in the equal equipment, for lack of a better term. Because he says, even if you qualify 10th, you can still win the race, which is true. We have seen people from every place on the grid win races this year, come from way back, especially the Suzukis. So obviously Max is a fan of MotoGP, but who isn't? And if you're not watching MotoGP, you should be, because this has been some seriously awesome racing this year, right? So even the F1 stars think there's good racing in MotoGP, folks, right? So how about a shout out to mechanic Alex Briggs, who put down his spanners and retired after Portimao. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm pretty sure I got this right, but I think Alex Briggs has worked for Valentino Rossi since Valentino entered MotoGP.
I do believe
on a 500.
I believe
that's
right.
Correct.
Yeah,
I believe I'm right with that.
It was him and Jeremy Burgess were there for the start of Valentino coming into Honda.
Correct. It's been a long, long career for Alex. I think most of us kind of really got to know Alex over his Twitter account, because he kind of really grabbed hold of the idea of Twitter and showed us different things on the bikes. And it was like, what is this part thing and all that different stuff. And he really had this really kind of cool insight, like, well, we're in the car convoy to the track, and we're doing, you know, well, I don't know what it was like, you know, we're doing only like 20 kilometers an hour or something. You know, he's like, you know, there was a whole documentation of him trying to get to the tracks, and, you know, here we are packing up, and here's the crates and all that stuff that we never see. We got to kind of see because of Alex. So I appreciate that, Alex. I love that part of that look into the garage, that deep look that we really can't get as fans that you gave us. You will be missed, sir. Enjoy your retirement in Australia.
Right. And that's, you know, there's kind of a lot of things that you could talk about with Alex Briggs. He's part of the Valentino Rossi juggernaut. Don't forget, you know, Valentino Rossi, as big as he was, he also had a supporting cast that was larger than life as well. I mean, Jeremy Burgess was well known throughout the paddock, very much loved, lovable guy, seen as a genius of setting bikes up and running a crew chief, right? Worked Valentino forever. Alex Briggs was the personal connection, it felt like, for us outsiders. Like, you know, he gave us a window to look into that we don't normally get, because paddock access is very limited in MotoGP to begin with. To get that close consistently, he would, you know, answer people's questions. He'd give you little games to look on Twitter. He kind of gave us the social media presence that Valentino Rossi, up until the last couple of years, really just wasn't even there, right? So that was as close as you were going to get to Valentino Rossi on most social media platforms. So that all played into it as well. But big, big shout out to this guy, because if you did follow his Twitter, you did realize when he went home, he had the to-do lists that were insane. He has little farm set up in Australia, so his work never stops. And I think this year, it was a perfect combination of everything which led to his retirement. One, the season starting later and going through this whole Corona schedule where he had to leave home and he couldn't go back. He already had a hard enough time with leaving home. He's got kids. He's got his wife. And to go back home and be gone for weeks at a time, now it was gone for many, many months. Pretty much in, you know, a good part of over three quarters of a year, he was gone from home. So he's looking at the rider he, you know, did all this amazing work with. He's been doing this forever. You're not going to be able to say, you know, he can still go anywhere he wants in Australia and turn wrenches for anybody if he wants to keep it local or whatever he wants to do. But this would definitely be the time. If I was in his shoes, I think this would be my calling card as well. It's like, you know what? I'm not coming back for this again. I've seen the show. I'm good.
Yeah, quick aside, Alex is married to Ellen Briggs, and she's a stand-up comedian in Australia. And I'm telling you, some of her tweets are so damn funny. You should really probably follow her, too. So the two of them sometimes had a little Twitter banter back and forth, which was quite funny. So, you know what? I don't know what you're going to do with him now, Ellen, because he's yours the whole time.
Right? We're going to put that marriage to the test now. You know, we're going to kick him out every couple of weeks.
Probably will. Like, when are you going back on the road?
I should just get more work all to right. do outside.
Well, for every fun thing that there is, there's always one thing that's going to be bad, because it is 2020 and it is the age of Corona, right? But with the coronavirus spreading like wildfire once again, doubts have been cast upon preseason testing. It is believed that Malaysia will not let the circus in for the country in February because of the high rate of infections that are there. There's also doubts that the Argentine, as well as the round in Coda in the United States, will be postponed, perhaps moved to the end of the calendar. Wouldn't you like Coda to be the last race of the year? I would, but not probably won't happen. But we don't know what's going to happen. It's just talk. It's just speculation. Everyone thinks that the season will begin in Qatar on the 28th of March, which I think is a couple of weeks later than normal. And it's probably going to be underneath very strict COVID rules, probably the same kind of COVID rules that we had this season. And then we'll see what happens. But I mean, I don't know about you, Skyler, but if you look at how things have skyrocketed here in the States, I can't see the MotoGP circus coming in here to Texas and racing. I just don't see it.
No, there's a couple of factors there. One, it's skyrocketing, and we just started getting cold. So we have, I mean, we're just starting flu season and everything else. This is when people normally get sick for this time of year. So they got to make it through that. And then it's also Texas, and Texas is a little, what's a nice way to put this? They're not down as much with the mask and shutting things down. And so it tends to spike in that state higher than other states that we have. And they have it on top of the third most populous state in the United States as well, if I believe.
Yeah, probably so.
I know the four most populous: California, Florida, Texas, New York.
Yeah, I know it's New York, California, and then I was going to say Florida before Texas, but not.
California's the most, dude, by far.
I thought New York got that back again.
Mm-mm.
Eh, who cares?
Anyway.
Doesn't matter. I'm in the middle of the country. I don't really care what happens.
Our European friends are probably getting a kick out of it. Like, we know more about your country than you do. Well,
you probably do. You get a real news media.
Yeah, seriously. I listen to BBC news just to hear about my own. Oh, it's sad.
Anyway, same here.
God, same here.
It's like, I want to really hear what's going on. I go look at the BBC website. Oh God. Let's stop right now.
That we're going to get some emails now about it.
It's going to be hatred. There will be hatred all over. Oh man, that was a can of worms that we should open. I'm gonna blame it on your beer. Okay,
we'll just walk out of that one slowly and go back to racing. So we had some Moto 3.
I'm not editing it out.
Oh no, we can keep on rolling with that. I'm good.
let's talk racing, for God's sakes. Okay, let's do what we're supposed to do.
So
here and talk
the racing,
right?
As I have mentioned at least a half dozen times, because I like to do so, is that I was gone on vacation for the last 4 days. So I kind of had to watch the racing when I could on hotel Wi-Fi, which actually wasn't half bad, and it was free, Jim. So that's a win.
It's a win-win.
That's right. And because it was a weird week and people weren't traveling, I swear the Wi-Fi was better, because there was like me and 20 other people in a 9-story hotel.
I totally agree with you because I've done a couple of shows from hotel rooms for travel for work reasons. And it's like the last one I did, it was during COVID, and it's like, well, there's me and 10 other people in a 150 room hotel. Wi-Fi is going to be great.
I'm not even exaggerating that either. I mean, you go down to the parking garage, there would be less than 20 cars there. And if you come back at night, there'd be 5 windows with lights on. And like you said, this is 10 floors, and each floor is at least probably 50, 60 rooms. I'm just like, yeah, this is hurting a little bit.
Yeah, no, that's it. This travel, hospitality and travel industries in the U.S. have been decimated by this thing, which is terrible.
Mm-hmm. And this is in a tourist town, too. This is in San Diego, which thrives on tourism. So that's crazy. All right. So, but my point of all of that was, I have, for some reason, only MotoGP notes. I did watch Moto 2 and Moto 3, but apparently I probably just wasn't able to take notes.
You can do it from memory. It's all good.
Well, that's the other thing. I was doing this after a day of visiting some breweries. So we're going to test how fuzzy this memory might be, but I'm sure Jim can carry us through most of it, especially the qualifying, which is going to full circuit bring us back around to the Moto 3 qualifying. Jim, why don't you start us off?
So in QP1, we had Binder, Ogura, McPhee, Fanade, Suzuki, and Arbolino. So two of the three championship contenders are in this first qualifying session. And I'm telling you, this first qualifying session was probably the wildest, wackiest, craziest Moto 3 qualifying session that there has been. So Ogura's going out, and he's having a tough old time with it. He's got head shake going on. He's tucking the front. He rolls right back into the pits and doesn't set a time. Like, what the heck are you doing? Okay, you got to go through. You got to set some times. And it's like he's waiting again in the pits. Like, okay, this kid's there's cool, right? And then there's astronaut cool. You know where I'm going here, Skyler? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But this kid was like off the chart cool. Like he just goes back in, sits back down. Like, dude, you are racing for a world championship. I could not do this. I would have to be on the bike because at least then I would not have nerves. He just nonchalantly sitting in a chair while they're changing tires on the bike. I'm like, I'm trying to think of what happened. I'm like, you know, Moto 3 bikes have a fair amount of torque and horsepower, but I don't know that they really have enough to, you know, spin a tire on the rim, or maybe they lost a wheel weight and so there's a weird vibration, so they're just changing them. You know, anything's possible. But he goes out to go set another lap after they put tires on it, and he comes right back into the pits again. And it's like, I think this time it was like, okay, he was looking to find somebody to kind of give him a tow. Everybody was kind of looking for somebody to be the guy who was going to lead them around the circuit, because the way this circuit is with the blind hills and blind crest, if you've got somebody in front to mark what's going on, that gives you a lot better ability to find your break points and to gauge off of them what they're doing so that you can do it just that little bit later, which makes you have that little bit faster lap time. So it's okay. So, all right, he sits back down again. The clock is ticking and this kid's back in the pit just sitting there. I'm like, whoa, this, I'm like, what the hell's going on? Like, this doesn't make any sense, because back out on track, Arbolino is now sitting up because he's not fast enough to actually go through. So he needs a lap, but he's looking around. He's sitting up. He's looking back. I'm like, what the heck is Arbolino doing now? Then the next thing you know, boom, there goes Agüero out with like just a little bit of time to spare. And you're just like, okay, what's happening now? And you're trying to watch what Arbolino's doing. Agüero goes by. Arbolino kind of looks at him. I'm thinking, well, okay, maybe he's going to jump on the back of him. But they don't get back around in time enough for Arbolino to get a lap. But as it shakes out, Binder, Suzuki, Agüero, one lap, one timed lap. That's all the kid put in. One time lap. And it was good enough to get through. Amazing. I mean, this kid's got astronaut ice cold vein water, blood flowing through his veins, which is absolutely amazing. And Antonelli makes it as well. So Binder, Suzuki, Agüero, Antonelli, they go through. Arbolino winds up being 13th, and it's like, what the heck happened? So Simon Crafar said that he misjudged it. He thought he could get one more lap in, so he was tooling around thinking he had more time than he did. It's like, wow. Arbolino, baby, of all the times to like pull that bonehead move, this is not the time to be doing that. But as you've said before, and we know, hey, guess what? Doesn't matter where you start in Moto 3, you got a damn good shot at getting to the podium.
That's right. And that's so, Max Verstappen's favorite thing.
It's Max Verstappen's favorite thing, right? That's why he's watching the racing, because you know, people can pass instead of like Formula 1 where we all just follow each other. Ooh, did I say that? Was that my inside voice? Nope.
I mean, you put a Mercedes in the back of the field, they can pass people. Mm.
That's true. Yeah, probably so. Anyway, quit that, because this is not a four-wheel podcast.
Yeah, go listen to Park Fermé if you want to do that.
So in the second qualifying session, well, we get out. We have Fernandez, Alcoba, Sasaki, and Aranis. They're the predominantly fast guys with about 6 minutes left to go. And again, everyone's looking for this reference again. Everyone is trying to find someone who can follow or whatever. Then Agüero just about tucks the front end and falls off at turn five. Like, this kid's having just like the world's worst qualifying, but somehow he's putting laps together. It's like magic or something. There was a big group of riders that was coming around at the end trying to get out of the pits, trying to get around the circuit and get that final last lap in. And they were so close, and they missed it by like a couple hundredths of a second for getting through. But when it finally all shook out, Fernandez was the fastest man. Alcoba, Sasaki, Suzuki, Agüero, again, one lap wonder, really. He just threw it together to get it there. And when he did that a second time, it kind of reminded me of the saying that Kenny Roberts Jr. had. Yeah, well, anybody can take a piece of shit and ride it hard enough to make it be on pole, but can you ride it that hard for 20 laps? So I was like, huh, that's a little bit crazy when we're going into this. But Agüero did start one place ahead of Arenas, who fell to sixth. Then Antonelli, Foggia, Masia, Rodrigo, Anchu, Garcia, Baltus, Vietti, Cooney, Migno, Toba, and Darren Binder is how it all shaped up for qualifying.
That is a Fernandez, man. Guy has been unstoppable.
Oh, Fernandez is 20, by the way. He just turned 20.
Okay. All right. We got that locked down.
Okay. Yeah. before somebody writes in and yells about that one.
Yeah, wasn't I supposed to do some chart? Oh, no, I did do a chart with birthdays, but you that was for MotoGP. That's right. I'm not doing it for anything else. So just MotoGP, that's it. I don't even know where that chart is. I'm sure there's been three birthdays at least since I created that, but at the very least. All right, so Ralph Fernandez, though, I mean, he is just on the form of his life right now.
Oh, yeah. There is no question about that. I mean, he's looking fantastic. So we go on to the race. What we find out is that there was going to be 7 riders that are going to receive long lap penalties in this race. And we know that Foggia and Masia are going to get the double long lap penalty for running around and being on the racing line, which admittedly, if you saw some of the photographs, those qualifying sessions and free practice sessions, there was guys like all over the track. And I mean, people were on a fast lap and they're just whizzing between two guys. And it was definitely, it was going to be messy if something bad were to happen. Well, anyway, something about that, Skyler?
Oh, no, I was just agreeing. I was just saying, yeah, okay. I'm just kind of, it's like that's shaking my head out loud, like, it's a mess.
So we start the race. Fernandez is out front, followed by Suzuki and Agüero, who makes an aggressive move on Arenas. I'm like, well, you know what? This is how this game is going to get played. There's a world championship on the table up for grabs. Arbolino in the first lap, made up like 8 places from his starting position. That was pretty incredible on a tight and twisty track. Now, Arbolino was going to get some help because a lot of the guys who had long lap penalties were going to be taking them ahead of him, which was going to give him places. So it was interesting to see where this was all going to shake out. Now, we got going and whatnot. And then, you know, it was pretty much, I was watching Arbolino pretty much. He had made his way to 12. Agüero was on Arenas like he was stuck to him with glue. But old Fernandez out front, he just simply had a 1.4 second gap. And he just kept putting down fast laps like there was nobody's business. Like he just kept going faster and faster and faster, and nobody could really kind of keep up with him. Now, Gurg kind of got dropped back to the end of the battle for second, and it was just that training of bikes that was basically Arenas, Alcoba, Agüero, Anshu, Sasaki, and Garcia. So you can intermix these guys in any which way or shape or form that you want it, kind of like Lego pieces, because that's really what was happening. The only consistent thing was the fact that Fernandez was checking out. Like, this boy was going to be gone because he was up to a 3-second lead in the race by about halfway through. And then with 10 laps to go, Fernandez actually had an 8.5-second lead. It was a beautiful race by Fernandez with nothing to lose. He was simply just gone out there. But it was basically, it's that whole race of what's going on. And what's really interesting is that Arenas had kind of pretty much dispatched with Agüero. So Arenas was running third, then Suzuki Anshu, and then all of a sudden, here comes this train, which was led by Foggia, who had the double long lap penalty, and Masia, who had the double long lap penalty. They had drug Arbolino up to the front pack. Well, then Arbolino winds up going by Agüero and dropping him to 10th. And then Arbolino just kind of keeps on going. So he actually races past Arenas. Now, this messed with Arenas in some way, shape, or form. It had to have, because at that point, Arenas was just kind of doing his thing. He had Agüero covered, and I think he was just going to ride on in 6th, and that was going to be the end of this, and championship is mine. The problem was, not only did Arbolino go past Arenas, but Arbolino went on by. Like, he took off in the distance and was gone, and Arenas couldn't match his pace. Well, now Arenas has really got the mind game going, because he's trying to do math while he's racing the motorcycle, which is not things that you need to be doing, right? Mm-mm. So he's like, wait a second, if Arbolino's gone, and wait a minute, if Arbolino wins this race, which, you know, probably wasn't going to happen because, like I said, somebody named Fernandez was 10 seconds up the road, but there was still that possibility that if Arenas was not close enough to Arbolino, that Arbolino could win this world title. Well, Arenas then starts to take the brain out, right? Call it red mist, call it stupidity, whatever. He starts making weird moves. He starts going up the insides where he shouldn't be. He's starting to run ragged. He's running scared. Like, his emotion has overcome him to where he's got to just calm down. Now, in all of this, I didn't see any pit boards. But at that point, if you are the crew chief of Arenas, you put the board out that says "calm down." You know, you put the breathe sign out. You know, and then you got to start giving him information of where Arbolino is. So you got to put like ARB P3 or whatever, and then tell him that you're P9. Equal okay, which means you're going to win the world championship. You have to have this communication, because you could tell that Arenas had no concept of what was happening, which wasn't going to work in any way, shape, or form for him. So it was going to, it went from like bad to worse for him. It just goes worse and worse and worse. So it's the wrong effect. He's trying to ride harder to go faster, but he can't. And so now he's going backwards. And isn't the harder he tries, the more backwards he winds up going, right? I mean, we see that this happen all the time. So all that's kind of going, that's all that's going by. But Binder had finally gone up, and he was racing at the front. He winds up actually going past Arbolino. So even Binder had through the pack, past Arenas and whatnot. So then we get to three laps to go, something like that. It's Fernandez, it's Faggia, it's Alcoba, Suzuki, Garcia. Then Suzuki goes down. Arenas is on, got a track limits warning. So now it's like, whoa, if he has to do a long lap, what's that going to do for all this? Like, this is going crazy. He almost high sides it out of turn four. Again, he's ragged because he doesn't know where anybody is. And then eventually, when it all comes said and done, the way it works out, Fernandez wins, and he wins it by a comfortable 5 seconds, but he had 10 seconds, so he was cruising that last lap. Faggia, who had a double long lap penalty, finishes in second. Alcoba gets a podium, then Garcia, and then Arbolino, who had kind of used up the tire on the back of the bike, getting to the front and didn't have a whole lot of grip left, slid back from a podium spot, had slid his way back to fifth. He did beat Binder to the line, then it was Vietti, then it's Ogura, McPhee, Anshu, Antonelli. Arenas, with all the crazy going on, had slid himself back to 12th, but that was good enough for him to be world champion. So congratulations, Albert Arenas, Moto3 world champion for 2020. Behind Arenas was Suzuki, Tatai, and Toba. It was a crazy race, craziest of the Moto3 races I think we've had all season, just because it all went crazy at the end. Fabulous race. Fair play to Arenas, but what's really scary about this, Arenas wins it on 174 points. Tony Arbolino was on 170 and only finished 4 points behind him. If Arbolino had not been next to that person who had COVID on the airplane and didn't have to deal with these, you know, COVID regulations and restrictions and quarantines and all that, Arbolino has a very good chance of being world champion. And I think if you COVID corrected, I think Arbolino is world champion, but that's neither here nor there, because if and buts are candy and nuts, we'd all have a very Merry Christmas. But a shout out to Agüero, who finished tied for Arbolino on 170. But since Arbolino had a win, he gets that point. Raul Fernandez was fourth, then Vietti for the championships in fifth, Masia, McPhee, Binder, Garcia, and the final place, Faggia. That is how the Moto3 season ended. And Arenas even did give ice cream out to everybody, because he did have the ice cream shop that showed up at the end. So, you know, that was the Moto3 race.
Yeah, and, you know, I think Arbolino, he had every chance to win it this weekend. You know, it was kind of, it was a missed opportunity as well, I think, whereas, like, yeah, there was the COVID race he missed, that you know, who knows, that race he might have crashed anyway. That's a tough one to call. But this weekend, he totally could have, if he would have just qualified better, not burned up his tire, he had the speed to go towards the front when Arenas was having his worst weekend in a long, long time as far as on-track performance. I mean, yes, he's been some crashes and been hit. That's nothing to do with his performance, but he was certainly running amok on the track. Out there, he looked like he just kind of took his brain out for about seven laps there in the middle.
Yeah.
Like, dude, what, you gotta focus. And I mean, that's
breathe, focus.
Yes,
those all should have been on some pit board somewhere.
But
right?
that's kind of what you. I don't want to say that that's what you expect in Moto3, but that's the kind of behavior that's going to happen at this level, because these guys are learning. They're young. This is the kind of thing that emotions. When you're a teenager and just barely beyond that, your emotions tend to run you and are more control than you want to admit. You don't really notice that till you're a little bit older and go, shit, I was stupid. And so there's a bit of that that goes on with that. And obviously he's a very talented individual, well deserving of the championship, Everybody had, I think, their shot. Ayagura had a shot to win the championship. You had to go and win. That's all you had to do. Everybody had to go and win. Everyone's got the same playing field. It was all up for grabs. But Arrhenius was the one who did enough to win it. So congrats to him and the Aspar team. Hell of a season. Hell of a Moto3 championship. Everybody that finished in the top, chin up. Great season. For those that will be back in Moto3 next year, they are going to be very, very dangerous at the top. We're talking Fernandez. We're talking maybe even Garcia might be. Ayagura for sure. I think Arbolino is moving up.
Ayagura goes up. Ayagura goes up too.
He's taking Moto2. He's going to Idemitsu, right? Up there.
Yeah, he goes up to Honda Team Agent Idemitsu. Yeah. And then is it Idzar? Idahar, goes back to Moto3 on that team. Yeah. I mean, I think if you're looking at it next year, I think Vietti, I think Binder, I think
Vietti's left. He's Moto2. He's going to go team up.
That's right. Binder's definitely in there, though. So, Binder, you don't know. I think that's definitely, you got to look at that.
It's Fernandez, Binder. Who the hell else? Because a lot of these guys are moving on. I don't know about Faggio.
Yeah, Fernandez is going to Moto2 with Io.
Oh, my goodness. So, it really is a bit. Okay. Well, we're going to call next season right now. It's Binder or Bust.
You know there's going to be some crazy Spanish kids that will show up somewhere.
Riders are coming on real strong because the Asian Talent Cup has pumped up a bunch over the last couple of years. I mean, Suzuki, Sasaki, and you've got Dennis Anshu, who's another one that could come have a really good strong year. John McPhee, you know, is going to be coming back for another year and get it thrown in the mix. So, it's, you know, Moto3 will be good next year. We definitely got some players.
They're not going to be good, right?
Great point, right? I mean, we always say this every time when someone moves on that's been a dominant force. When Brad Binder left, when Juan Mir left, right? You're watching these guys, who's going to be the next guy? There's always the next guy. We've really just got to get used to this now.
Mm-hmm. We should be. Oh, you know, one little nerdy tech thingy that I saw that I looked at, you know, if you have the MotoGP pass, you can pick your cameras that you want to see. So Arrhenius has an onboard on his bike, and he's had it on there, I think, all year, but it's underneath the fairing and it points back at him. I noticed that over I didn't go any farther back than like the last five races because I figured that was enough, but I went back and you can count the rings for the position of the forks in the triple tree. He had the same number for the last five races. I did. They never moved the forks up or down in the triple tree. So he had a setup that he liked. He just wasn't going to walk away from it, I guess, you know?
Yeah, I mean,
he found a sweet spot, and that was where it was going to be.
That's a lot of my experience when I was working out, of course, again, where my shitty little world of racing, as a Mark Miller might said. But when I was working on the team, once we kind of got the bike in, then again, we raced on like three different tracks. We didn't play with the ride height too much. It was more so, you know, how many clicks, you know, rebound and compression we were messing with. And
sure.
We messed with changing the length of the bike a lot more than we did the height of the front end. So there's a lot of, you know,
I guess what I was expecting was by moving the front end, you can put more weight on the front or less weight on the front. Mm-hmm. So given the fact that you're at Portimao and you're going up and over all these hills and all these crests, I expected you to move those forks to put more weight on the front end to have a better feel on some of those corners. So yeah. I guess that's where I was headed more than anything else. But
I guess
you can do the same thing, but just in the rear ride height too. And I have no idea if they were or weren't. So,
well, those parts of the track are real funky though too, because they're not, I mean, they're a lot of times they're set up. So the riders they've got to manipulate the machine. They've got to, you know, get up on the pegs and sit up over the gas tank and that kind of thing. Right. Whereas the corner isn't dictating so much the change. It's the roller coaster before the corner and getting it settled down. So
good point.
There's a lot to mess with there as well. But I would not want to show up to Portimao the first time and try to figure out what the hell setup I'm running on this track. Because that track just throws everything at you.
Hey, ask Valentino Rossi that one.
Zoinks.
Ouch.
I guess we should get our way through Moto2 because, I mean, we're facing down an hour and we haven't got into Moto2 yet. We still have MotoGP. So,
Quickly. Qualifying one. Quickly, Moto2 qualifying. So in the first one, Bezzecchi, Manzi, Luthi, Schroeder, Martin are all in that first one. So Bezzecchi, Bowman, Schneider, Martin, and Buliga go through to the second round. The interesting thing that happens in QP2 is Aaron Canet. He's going over the crest just before turn 8, and he's already crashed the bike. So him and the bike go over the crest together. Now, mind you, this is a blind crest. So Kinnett is trying to put his hands on the ground, and he spins himself around so he can see oncoming traffic. Okay, self-preservation, survival mode. He gets slow enough where he stands up, and I kid you not, five guys come over the crest of the hill. Kinnett is standing in the middle of the track, and they split him. Now, I'm not sure how fast a Moto 2 bike goes across there, but I'm figuring it's easily over 100 miles an hour, probably in that section of the track. And as cool as a cucumber, again, astronaut cool, Kinnett stands there, everybody goes by, he runs 90 degrees to the track. Now, at that point, me, I would be looking for some place to change my underwear and my leathers because they would have been completely brown, okay? Not Kinnett. He simply, once he gets to the edge of the track, he just goes running for the bike to find it. Like, now, this is a part where I want to be sure that everyone understands this clearly. I am not going to complain about the people who were running the corners or flagging or anything like that. I'm going to ask this question of race control. Given the fact that that was a blind crest, that five guys had come down that hill, missed Kinnett and missed his bike, and after Kinnett had got to his bike and picked it up on what would essentially have been the proper racing line to enter that corner, why was there not a red flag? Because I know that that would have been an instant shutdown of that racetrack if it had been club. Now, granted, they know a lot more. Race control knows a lot more about who's where and where on the track than what we do, especially from that view. But I was shocked that there was not a red flag at that part of the track. Now, I'm sure there was waving yellows like mad for everybody who was coming over that hill, but I thought that was a little bit odd. If you want to see that incident, it's on my Twitter feed, at MotoRGV. It's a retweet of the MotoGP feed. It's crazy. It was definitely scary stuff.
I think what some of it has to do, now, again, our corner marshaling friends will write into us because they have greater insight than what you and I do. But what I would think is because of the bang-bang nature of what happened, right? He went down, he's sliding down the track, yellow flags go out. Red flags have to be a called thing from race direction, I think.
Yes.
I think the
That's why
can't
I was
decide.
Addressing my point to yeah. race control. Is like, I would think race control would want to shut that down.
That's what I say. So with that, it happens so quick. Can race control – the whole thing happens within 20 seconds, right?
Sure.
He goes down. Yeah. So he goes down, flags go out. You got to figure 5 seconds go by before anybody can call back to race control. We have a rider who's standing in the middle of the track. So that's by the time that call goes back, they go, can you confirm if he's safe? Okay, another 5 seconds have gone by. At that point, they're like, they're radioing back, like, he's running off the track. Okay, yellow flags until it's over, right? It happens. That communication chain takes a little bit to get going. So I can see why the red flag, unless he was KTFO in the middle of the track, I don't know if they'll have quick enough to be able to get the red flags out. And they'd have to, it'd be a judgment call that they'd have to leave to maybe one of the, like I said, maybe one of the turn marshal folks can write into the show and let us know, like, hey, maybe the corner captain has the little bit more leniency to say, hey, we're going to throw the red flag because we see the rider in a dangerous situation. Maybe that was something that spoken to the people who are in the area. It's like, hey, you're over a blind area, so if something happens, you need to stop the race, let us know. But yep.
It's all valid points. I'm only questioning. I'm just looking for why. And, I'm sitting there thinking we really lucked out with what happened in Austria.
Yes.
And so now we have not the same thing, but I will call it very similar thing where we have, an area where no one sees it coming and there's this problem. So it was, again, everybody was through it. It's fine. It's just a question, and I'm an armchair. I can armchair this all I want because I'm here. So I'm going to. That's how that one goes. But still, it was crazy. 2020 does not disappoint. It is all about the crazy. It is all about this. And basically, we're halfway through the qualifying at this point. Lowe's, who is riding with this incredibly sore wrist, we all know that his right wrist is bad. And think about trying to ride Puerto Mayo with a wrist that's swollen up the size of like a grapefruit.
Nope.
I can't even begin to imagine. And
no thanks.
If it was your left wrist, I could see where you can have that time on the straightaway to release your hand, flex your wrist, try to work with it. You don't have that with the side of the bike that he's got with the right, because you got a throttle and a brake you got to deal with. And somehow Lowe's is like at the top. Amazing. He was followed by Fernandez, by Martin, by Vietti, by Navarro, or sorry, by Marini, then by Vietti, then Navarro, and Jorge Martin. Now, Baldassare was down in 13th, but when the qualifying checkered flag came out, it was Remy Gardner who snuck to the top and took his pole position, which was great to see. He only beat Marini by 11 tenths. That was all he did it by. It was close, very close, but hey, poles are poles. Then followed by Fabio Di Giantonio, then Bastianini, who would start fourth, which was a good position for him. He was 13th. He was able to put a lap in. He got where he needed to be on those first two rows. We kind of realized that the first three rows are critical to be on for Moto 2. Lowe's had pretty much packed it in at the halfway point, and had that lap that Lowe's put in stood up for a fifth place. He only lost four positions, which I think is amazing effort by Sam Lowe's. Then Martin, Buliga, Fernandez, Ramirez, Nagashima were all your top 10 in that. Joe Roberts would start 18th. So that was the qualifying. So Moto 2 race. In the race, we start off and we got Marini getting a hole shot. Then it's Di Giantonio. And then Di Giantonio's bike, he looks like he got hit there, and he kind of goes down a little bit. I'm not sure what had happened with that part of it, but it was definitely a little bit of contact there in that first set of corners and whatnot. Then you had was only there because he had flubbed the start. Like Di Giantonio like dropped the clutch and nothing happened. It was just really bad. So that was all in this turn 2-3 area where it was. And then Remy almost hit him, and it was kind of crazy there at the beginning of the race. And you had Gartho that was there at the beginning because he kind of worked his way – or sorry, Gardner got past Marini then because of all this tangle up in the 2-3 area, and Di Giantonio taking a hit in the bike and all this kind of stuff, because – There was that tumble at the first turn. That's really kind of what it was, where Di Giantonio fell, and then he got taken out by who was that? Who hit Di Giantonio in the ribs? That's what I was trying to say, which I totally flubbed that all up. But that all started out there in the beginning. It was pretty crazy at that first part of the race. Then Marini got out front, and pretty much it was like a Marini show at that point. Marini was there, and he led for a fair amount of the race. And then, you know, Lowe's was running out of steam with like 11 laps to go. There wasn't too much he had left in him. I don't think Lowe's had any more effort or stamina to get into there. Gardner was definitely trying to hunt down Marini. He had pace, and it looks like it was going to be good there. Now, Bastianini had gotten past Fernandez to take fifth, which would be good enough for the championship. He was riding smart, didn't have anywhere to go. But with five to go, Marini, Gardner, Lowe's. Amazing that Lowe's is in third. I mean, he's definitely fallen off. There's a gap between Marini and Gardner to Lowe's. Then Bezzecchi, Bastianini, and Fernandez. They're all running very well. Lowe's winds up going too deep, and he's trying to dig deep if he's got to win. He's really digging, but he needs the win to get the world championship. It doesn't happen, but the person who does dig deep is Gardner. Gardner goes through the lead with two to go. He finally got past Marini, and so Jeremy Gardner wins his first MotoGP race. He beats Luca Marini to the line. Lowe's with an amazing effort. I don't know, and it's probably on the level of superhuman for him to have raced that bike and finish third and give it all that he had was incredible. Then Bezzecchi, Bastianini, who is your world champion, Jorge Martin, Joe Roberts went from 18th to 7th, which was a good race for Roberts. Again, sometimes we see brilliance, sometimes we don't. It's kind of weird. Then Fernandez, Baldassare, Vierge, Ramirez, Schroeder, Bowman, Schneider, Nakashima, and Canet rounding out the point scorers for Moto 2. So that's kind of how that one went. There wasn't much there. I mean, you know, say what you want, Skyler, but it was definitely the Gardner and Marini show there with Lowe's as a side act. And we were really all just watching what was going to happen with where Baldassare was going to wind up finishing. So yeah, where it is.
what I liked about this is you saw a couple things with this race, right? Titles that weren't necessarily the championship that I like to, you know, hand out. Maybe most improved rider we got to see this year is Remy Gardner. We've been waiting for him to make this step, and now he's been – you've been waiting for this. It's been simmering. It boiled, and it finally boiled over into the, you know, a win. And we've seen it in the qualifying. We've seen him front racing this year, and it's more consistently at the front without tossing it down into the weeds, right? So really strong competitor next year. Luca Marini, he screwed his head back on right for the final round. We had mentioned he just didn't look right for the last couple of rounds, especially Valencia. It's too bad he didn't have his head screwed on a couple rounds ago because it would have made the championship a little bit more interesting at the very end. But still, a great show there. Sam Lowe gets Tough Man of the Year award. That was a performance from start to finish all week long, looking strong. And to be as beat up as he was, to go in there and do and still perform this great. If he had not had that crash, which messed up his wrist, he, you know, the championship might have gone his way. But like you said, if buts, candy nuts.
That's right.
Bezzecchi, he has been, I think, the star of Moto2 this year that's really shined the brightest. Sam Lowes has had a great season, but we knew Sam had this in him. But Bezzecchi, this is his sophomore year. We didn't really know. Or, wait, is this his sophomore or rookie year? It's his... Bezzecchi? Is this his first year?
Bezzecchi, this is his first year. Yeah. He moved from second because he moved at the same time with Martin. So Martin had the factory KTM with the KTM frame last year. Now he was still in IO's factory KTM team, but on a Kalex. So it's their second year in.
Right. Okay. Perfect. But it, you know, a sophomore season was shown, and you know, championship contender this year. You have to expect one of the, you know, four favorites probably going into next year, along with Lowe's and Gardner, as a championship contender for sure.
Easily.
Bastianini, a great season. I didn't peg him as winning the championship this year. Actually, I don't think I pegged anybody for winning the championships they did this year, but that's why I don't bet. He looked every bit as consistent this year. Definitely could put the laps down when he needed to. Did just enough. I think he could have gone faster over this weekend, but he was just like, hey, I'm in to win the championship. I'm not screwing this up. So he, you know, held it there nicely. Jorge Martin, had it not been for the COVID test, where would he have been? He missed.
Hey, where would he have been if they didn't have track limits and take a race win away from him? Let's not even go there.
Now that horse has already been beat to death.
yeah, but I like flogging it. Sorry.
Yeah, no, we get our sticks out. We do it quite often. There has a dead horse that hasn't been beat by us, but I digress. Joe Roberts, you know, nice to see what we've been wanting kind of come to fruition as Americans, like seeing someone who's coming up through Moto2, not, you know, like we're waiting. We are dying to have
next year
our next superstar. And you know, great point that leads me into it. I was just scrolling through Instagram today while I was waiting at the store in line, which I did a lot of, if you didn't catch that earlier. but I did see that Bobier was already overseas with the team, was taking pictures, getting comfortable on the bike, and so was Robertson and Ilta Trans because they start testing tomorrow. So that is going to be great to see what Cambo can do and what Robertson is going to do. And definitely an exciting time for us U.S. motorcycle racing fans. If it wasn't already enough, we're always excited about this stuff. But having some Americans back up there that we know can compete is going to be great. And seeing Lorenzo Baldessari kind of drag himself out of the gutter this year, I mean, I just feel like I can just keep going down this list. The talent that is in Moto2 is insane. Everybody's got a story. Everyone's got – I mean, Bo Benschneider – we didn't even mention him in the first three quarters of the season. All of a sudden, he's up there making a name for himself again. There's
with
of course,
NTS.
Yes, right, that's right. And there's a couple, you know, there's also people who we could say it's just like, what happened to Nagashima? You kind of just that you lied to us at the beginning of the season. Essentially, we thought you were coming on form and just never showed up again like that. Schroeder is definitely taking a step back, but I think that entire team with Luffy as well, that Liquid Moly Intact GP team, just I don't know if they lost their way or if the riders, I don't know. But yes, Moto2 championship this year was another exciting one. All congrats to Nea Bastianini. Definitely deserve a champion. Luca Marini, he's going to be moving up. Another deserving. Sam Lowes, he's going to be back next year ready to go. Bezzecchi's going to be ready to go. Martin's going to be ready to go. Gardner's going to be ready to go. Roberts,
Well, Martin went to Ducati.
Oh, that's so right, Martin. That. So, yeah, scratch that. He's up there. I mean, it's just...
Well, think about it. Gardner, Lowe's, Bezzecchi, Roberts.
And that's, who knows? And who knows? Because there's always something that we don't know about
yet. Who's the person who's going to take that step? Because you don't know who's going to take the step. Because right. Kinnett could take the step.
Yep.
Right? Vierhey could get it all together. Yep. So there's a lot of in-between that's in there that is possible. So
we'll have to wait and see. But
I'm impatient.
The good news is, well, the season isn't so far away right now. That can change, but we don't need to go down that path because we're trying to stay on the upbeat, Jim, which takes That's us right. into MotoGP qualifying.
Yeah, so in MotoGP qualifying in the first round, it was delayed. Zarco was out in FP4. He popped the engine. He's on the outside in the gravel on the big sweeping fast turns 14, 15 that end the lap, and then he just cuts across the track to go into the pits. I really don't quite understand what Zarco was thinking on that one. But, hey, that's what he did. So we were delayed probably 25, 30 minutes to get in there. The first session was had Mir, Morbidelli, Binder, Rossi, and Cal Crutchlow all there. Espargaro and Binder were really fast at that point. But Cal and Morbidelli make it through to get into the qualifying session, which was good to see for them. Binder had tried to go for it, but he couldn't get the. He had a bad last sector and couldn't get in there. We go to QP2. We had Nakagami, who was in pain after a FP4 crash, so he was trying to shake off a bit of some cobwebs and some hurt and some pain. He was a little ginger on the bike and getting off of it. Quartararo had a really big moment at turn 14. Morbidelli, using all the experience he had gained from the first qualifying session, was followed by Miller. There's the guy with the big balls we were talking about. Zarco looking fast there as well, with Vinales, Paul Espargaro, and Dovi all there. Then Zarco crashed at turn 8, and then it seemed like out of nowhere, here comes Portugal's own Miguel Oliveira to snatch the pole, beating out Morbidelli, then Miller to finish off the front row. Crutchlow was fourth at one point Crutchlow was at the pole or very near it, I believe, and looked, I mean, for a final swan song, you couldn't have asked probably more from Crutchlow in that respect. Then Quartararo with a decent qualifying. Quartararo finally in the top five. I mean, we haven't seen him that high up in a qualifying spot for quite some time.
He at least probably before,
I was going to say before Le Mans at least.
Yeah, I mean, he was the qualifying master, and it shows because he took home the qualifying BMW M2 award this year.
Yes.
And just to go to show you how good his qualifying was at the beginning of the season, because as of late, you would have forgotten that he did anything good at the beginning of the season, because it's just gone so far backwards. Especially when we get to the championship a little later on.
Yeah. Shockingly, Stefan Bradl qualified sixth. Didn't really think we'd see that coming, but it shows you what happens when you have consistent seat time and you're working out through your solutions and you get something that's good. You're pretty much on a level playing field because Bradl really was finally on a level playing field, to be honest, because everybody's had experience at all the other tracks that they've been to. And Bradl hasn't really had racing experience on them. And now nobody has any experience at Portimao. So he looks pretty good and he's in sixth, which was great to see.
Just to add a caveat, because sure people are screaming at you about that.
Okay,
Bradl has MotoGP experience at many of these tracks. It's just been a while.
Yeah. I was talking about having current Michelin data.
Somebody was like, he's been in MotoGP, you guys. Yeah. Like, we know.
Yes, thank you for saving the emails. Save me from email drudgery. Yeah, yes. Then Zarco was seventh, Vinales, Espargaro, Rins. Oh, and we didn't, you know, and then Nakagami and then Dovizioso, realizing that our world champion
was hungover.
Juan Mir isn't even in Q2.
Yeah,
Suzuki.
Yeah, he did not look himself.
Looked like there was something going on and nobody kind of knew what was happening. And it's like, we'll have to figure this all out once it becomes race day. So we get to race day. At the beginning, Oliveira gets a hole shot, followed by Morbidelli, Miller, Crutchlow, and Brattle. Now, Mir is well into the back of it, and Mir and Zarco, they come together, and Mir was so close to going down. Now, Brad Binder crashed at turn one, so all this craziness is happening the first couple of laps, and we kind of found out later on, like, Mir's in the back of the pack, and, like, what really happened, and we go backwards, because what we find out is sort of like the whole dust kind of settles on the first couple of turns, and we see this shot of Benyaya, who's riding with his right arm down, and he's trying to shake it, and he can't really get on the gas to make the bike go, and you're thinking, really, what's wrong with Benyaya? And he winds up riding into the pits, and it's like, okay, maybe there's a mechanical problem with the bike or something, and we finally get a replay. Mir absolutely just clotted into the side of Benyaya at turn three on this track, and he just hit him so hard that he actually popped his shoulder out, dislocated his shoulder, but Benyaya said it popped back in, but the pain was intense. And if you've ever had a dislocated shoulder, the pain is incredible, so they tell me. I've never done it, but...
Well, actually, I've done exactly what he's done. When I was playing football, I came up and delivered a good size hit on a running back who had about 30 pounds on me. So we had a nice collision. My shoulder popped out, and as I went and landed on the ground, it popped back in. And I can tell you, it's hard to pick your arm up like he was doing, where he's leaning off the side and he's trying to like grab his own wrist and pull it back up. That's what happens to you. You get a busted wing real quick. And I actually, because it didn't set when I popped back in, it actually didn't go back in right. So now I have surgery ahead in my lifetime at some point, because I have a loose socket where my shoulder just kind of rolls around and pops. And if I twist it hard enough, it'll pop back out. So dislocated shoulders, not something you want to do in your life, but they can happen. So I totally understand when he says it got popped out and popped back in while he had to pull in. It is excruciating, especially if it's your first time that you've dislocated your shoulder. The first time is always the worst, because it becomes like a paperclip effect. After that, you start bending, it can happen more often, and the pain, you can push and grit your way through it a little bit easier. But that first one, whew, man, it is not fun.
So with five laps down in the race, Oliveira is already 2.5 seconds in front of everybody else. Like, that doesn't happen in a MotoGP race unless your name is Marc Marquez, right? But it was amazing. Oliveira was basically pretty much close to checking out. I mean, he was, at this point, he was getting ready to check out. He definitely had thrown the keys back on the table, the counter at the hotel, and was getting ready to go. But wow, just 2 seconds and five laps is pretty crazy. It was Morbidelli, Miller, Crutchlow, Spalsberger, and Brattle after that. There began to be a queue that started to build up behind Paul Espargaro. There was the train, and he was sort of the engine of that train. And he was kind of holding the other people that were behind him up a little bit. So Paul wound up losing the front at one point. He saved it a la Marc Marquez. Kind of interesting. He's riding a bike that he's going to have to do that on more often come next year. But then, you know, Mir winds up retiring with 10 laps to go. I mean, it becomes one of those, well, what's wrong with the bike? And I think I have this right. If I don't, write in, tell me I'm wrong. But I think the Suzuki's actually tried the asymmetric hard rear. So where you've got hard compound, but the other one side is just a little bit softer versus just having the same compound across the entire tire. And it looks like maybe that didn't work well for the Suzuki's or something to that effect. That's my guess, because also Alex Rins was nowhere to be found either. And I think both Suzuki's started on that asymmetric tire. It was pretty crazy for that to have happened. But essentially, by all accounts now, it's basically Oliveira out front. There is Miller and Morbidelli who are kind of going after each other. Miller's closing him down, but he hasn't quite got there yet. Zarco was having a little bit of a dice with Crutchlow for fifth. Zarco got by with that. With five to go, Oliveira's gone. No one's touching Oliveira. As long as the bike does not fail him, he is going to win this one. He's in another zip code compared to everybody else. Doby had worked his way through the pack kind of strategically, and he had made his way up to be behind pole, and then Nakagami was there, but Nakagami was in the group too, and Cal was going through that turn one, and he wound up going really wide with five to go, lost a few places there. But the last lap is really where it gets interesting. Oliveira comes home as the winner, but Miller winds up putting a beautiful pass on Morbidelli to take the second position. So Oliveira wins it, Miller, Morbidelli. Espargaró holds on for fourth in the KTM. So you had two KTMs in the top four. Then Nakagami, Dovizioso. So Nakagami wound up getting by Dovizioso. Bradl finished seventh, which I think is really pretty good for Bradl. Then Aleix finishes eighth. Alex Marquez, Zarco fell down to 10th. Then Vinales, Rossi, Crutchlow, Quartararo, and Rins finished 15th. Terrible day at the race for Suzuki. They wound up losing the Triple Crown. Ducati won the manufacturer's title on the strength of Jack Miller's ride to second place. So Suzuki missed out on that. Brad Binder, even though he did crash, he wound up being Rookie of the Year for MotoGP, which is pretty impressive. And that is it for MotoGP. It was really... I don't want to say boring race, but it lacked all the intrigue and excitement of the two other races just because there was no championship to be decided. And with Oliveira basically checked out front, it was a little bit of a snooze fest.
Right. There's interesting stories, right? Watching Miguel Oliveira do what anybody wants to do in their hometown race. He has been Portugal's hero for quite some time. He is a superstar over there. Because he's the first Portuguese rider to make it to MotoGP, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, that's correct.
He essentially was like on the board to get this track built back in the day, and that's where he spent a lot of his time riding. And while he was building himself up when he was coming through like Moto2 and everything else, he gets this magnificent win that we, you know, you could only dream of, and just unfortunately because of the year it's been, he can't celebrate it in front of anyone. And if you
could you imagine the crowd?
Oh,
what they would have sounded like.
Oh yeah. Oh. I mean, just it'd have been a ruckus. That place can pack 100,000 people, no problem. And they would have all been on their feet clapping
really?
For him. Oh yeah, they can pack in a ton of people
really?
At that place. It's
I didn't
massive.
Think they could put that many in there. I didn't think they could put that many in there, but that's okay.
Yep.
They
designed that track within the hopes of getting MotoGP and F1 as a regular player. And
well, I told
in,
you right now, they need a life contract.
Oh, dude, the track is great. I mean, we've known awesome. This from World Superbike days. That it's a shame that isn't there, but what I think the main thing is they're not willing to play the give us all the money to bring our show game, which all kudos to them because that's probably why the track is surviving and others don't. They're not going to pay the $15 million to bring in MotoGP or the, what is it for F1? It's like over $20 million now to bring them in or something like that.
Oh, gosh. It's ridiculous.
Oh. And ridiculous. You wonder why your ticket is $400 for 2 days because the tracks still have to break even. They're not even making money on half these events. But anyway, he gets that. So that was amazing to see him do that, go out there and finish the season like that. The Jack Miller Morbidelli round two, that was a great battle to see. Miller looks like he learned his lesson last time. Like, get past him, don't let him come, don't give him any opportunity to get back, and just let the power of the Ducati get him. Pol Espargaró, he had a nice little comeback there at the race after blowing himself wide in the corner, crawled himself back up. Taka Nakagami, another top five. He's just got half a step more to make. And next year he could be a player at the front all the time and even the championship. Dovizioso finishing out strong. Stefan Bradl grabbing a top 10 and finishing 7th. He was sitting on the couch doing some testing duties. No way he thought his season was going to lead to this year. Has, you know, goes back in kind of semi-retired, I would say, as a test rider. Full season and a crazy schedule. Not too shabby at all. Aleix Espargaró getting in 8th place there for Aprilia. He even said before the race, he's like, hey, I've got great tire life all the way through. If I can just maintain a high position in the beginning, I'll be good to go at the end. He was not lying. Alex Marquez, probably the person I was going to be on down the most this year and have reversed the most this year as well, where I came in the season like he's just there because, you know, it's Alex Marquez. He was the most available guy, and he's Marquez's brother. Like, wow, what a great year to have promotion for Repsol. And he's gone beyond all my expectations. So much kudos to him. I can't wait to really see what he does with another year under his belt in GP. Zarco making a comeback season, getting in the top 10. You know, after the whole KTM debacle, we wondered if his head was in the game in the right space to go to another bike that wasn't a Yamaha and get his shit together and get going. And he proved that he can, and he's going to be actually jumping up into the Pramac seat. So it's going to be great to see him move up there. And this is where, except for one person, this is where it all starts going downhill, right? 11, 12, Cal Crutchlow slides it at 13th to kind of break it up, but 14th, Quattro. So Vinales, Rossi, and Quattro, 11, 12, 14th. That 2020 Yamaha, and remember everybody, Morbidelli's on the 2019 B-Spec bike, right? These guys are all on the 2020. And man, did that just manufacture a team, everything lose its way this season. Quite embarrassingly so, I have to say, that they could not get their heads with all the might, all the money, all the experience, all the talent, because look at those riders. That's no shabby lineup. And to just disintegrate like they did this year. And I got to tell you, there's not a lot of hope for next year because these bikes are going to be very similar because of all the limitations in development because of the coronavirus going into next year. Ooh, I don't know, man.
I don't want to be on a Yamaha next year.
You don't. And that's, when have we ever said that? Since before Rossi got there, probably. That's about it.
Maybe. You know, here's the interesting thing. And this deserves a more of a discussion as an off-season, you know, review thing is Yamaha and their woes. But just the fact that, like, why don't you just go, you know, Quattro's complaining, well, the bike doesn't feel right to me. Well, why don't you go give him Morbidelli's B-bike and see if he goes faster on it. If he does, get him an oval frame. You know? I mean, that's what Honda would do. They would go get a different frame. They would roll one out of a museum from somewhere or something, you know?
Yeah, you can't do that, though, man. The amount of money they spend, I mean, there's...
Honda doesn't care. They want to win. So winning is, well, if Marquez says that he needs the 2018 chassis to go fast, then guess what? They'll go find an old 2018 chassis, well, and they will give it to him.
Maybe
you know?
They're running things different, but here's how I look at it. From the perspective of being the boss,
okay.
I make the decisions. I say, we're going 2020 frame. I hire this guy to be my technical director. He hires the guys to make his whole team work, right? They okay. come out, shit the bed this season. Riders say, we want last year's bike. There's no way as a boss I could say, yeah, just throw all that money and development time away and then I'm going to walk into the head office in Japan and be like, oh yeah, thanks for the $35 million in development. We actually are using last year's stuff. No worries though. You're going to trust me to work this out next year, right? Oh, hell no. Your ass is out on the next bus out of Japan. I'm telling you right then and there because there's no way you can look at it. So anytime they got to make a step up like that, they've got to ride with that decision because they have to have full confidence they can turn around. It just did not work out this season, but it's not a good look. And I'm telling you, Jim, I'm going to stick with this. Things are going to look different and people are going to be different at Yamaha next year. Outside of the riders with Quattro jumping, new mechanics because guys from Rossi are leaving. But I think we'll get notification at some point in the season that there's new heads of, you know, the guys you don't normally see or hear about outside of like Lynn Jarvis. There will be new people at Yamaha because this was bad enough, even though with like, you know, wins and everything else. It's just how it all portrayed because they should have had the championship, especially with Mark being out this year. They should have decimated everybody and they shit themselves, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, this is definitely a conversation for later, definitely.
For sure. We can go on about that. But that gives us our championship. As we know, 2020 MotoGP champion is Joan Mir on 171 points. Franco Morbidelli, he came in there, gets second place, highest Yamaha, and guess what? Second place in the championship, privateer team. Wow, that is amazing. What a crazy year. Alex Rins, he has third, just a few, you know, not too far back there. He, you know, maybe if he didn't get beat at the beginning of the season, but he also didn't have a great last race. So, Alex Rins third. Dovizioso, the unemployed guy, finishing fourth in the championship and being unemployed. He finished right in front of Paul Espargaró. He was tied on points, but because of Dovizioso's finishing positions over the season, eked him out there. Magic Vinales slipped back to sixth in front of Jack Miller, who probably would have placed higher, but or at least he was tied with Maverick Vinales. A lot of ties going on here. But obviously we know Miller's had less luck in podium results because of things he can't control. Quartararo, the championship leader heading into Terol. So what are we talking, Jim? Like five maybe rounds ago, he was the championship leader, and he finishes in eighth.
You talk about the wheels falling off the wagon.
Yes. Ooh. Yes. I think this is good for him, though, because he had a year of success and then a year to get beat up. How are you going to pick yourself up? Can you learn from this? Can you pull your... Because this is MotoGP. Like you said, when you're at a pro level, what do you have to do every weekend, Jim?
You got to bring it every weekend.
That's right. So if you learn to fail and overcome, then you learn to do what?
You learn how to win.
That's right.
You learn how to be consistent.
That's right. So maybe we might see Quartararo, you know, this is his second year, you know?
Yeah.
I think he can make some strides next year. It's going to be good. Miguel Oliveira finishing in the top 10. KTM, man, we could just go on about how KTM this year went from the, oh, wouldn't it be cool to see them get a top five to, wow, they didn't get a top five? That's a surprise. What a flip. I mean, they have made such progression that year. All congrats to them and their rider. And Taka Nakagami, probably the like quiet hero and the most heartbroken rider of the year. Even more than Quartararo, just because he had a podium and first win in his hand. It just one teeny tiny mistake, and it was gone in an instant. But, Jim, another year goes by. What a crazy year. I got to tell you, it took forever to get it started, and it went by in a flash.
Yeah, it was 147 days from the race in Qatar to the championship. Jeez. Being decided. Oh, it's crazy. Man.
It is crazy. And I don't ever want this format again. This was from a podcast standpoint.
I don't either.
I can do the on and off every other week. That works out well. Maybe a few back to backs here and there, but not triple headers. And if we, me and you, us talking heads that do this on our own time, if we are tired and try to do this, I can't imagine what these riders and the teams and all the transportation personnel, all of the organization, how tired and exhausted they must be. So to everyone involved in getting this show going this year, congrats and thank you for delivering such a wonderful MotoGP season all through every single rank. It's been a pleasure to watch and cover this year.
It has been fantastic.
All right, Jim. Well, with that and the incredibly long show that we pumped out, which is only fitting since it's the last one that we will be doing for a while. And to be honest, everyone, I think me and Jim are going to crawl into a cave for a little bit and we'll reappear sometime in December and maybe push that out to January. We will have to wait and see. But we'll be back, but we definitely need a break just like everyone else. Yes, I did too. And I've got kid prep to do, man. For those of you that pay attention, we are at less than 7 weeks now. So it's a coming. It's a coming. My boy, his kid showed up in the world 2 days ago. So that's the first of the next. So there's starting with, because there's been a couple that are already earlier this year, but starting with his daughter, about every 3 to 5 weeks is a due date until April for all my friends. Yeah. So a lot of kids coming in the next period of time.
That's what quarantine will do for you.
For real. We did not practice our social distancing, that's for sure.
Yes, you did not.
But it's going to be crazy time, so that may intervene. But Jim and I will have some time to talk, especially when we get on. We can do rant shows. Oh, those might even get longer just because we'll forget what the hell we were talking about, why we even started the show.
But I get some ideas for some rant shows, but I need a couple of 3 weeks off before we do that.
Yes, yes. We need some. We'll come back a little bit fat and happy and probably do maybe one show, then jet out for Christmas and New Year's, and then come back and get it all going again. But remember, folks, this is the perfect time for you to email us and say, hey, what do you want to hear from us this offseason? Do you want to join in the conversation? Hey, maybe even you want to come in on the podcast and offer your 2 cents. I don't know. We're willing to try everything. But go ahead and shoot us an email, and you can do that by sending it to motopod@motopodcast.com. You can even hit us up on Facebook. We're there at facebook.com/motopod. That's the Motopod fan page. You can go ahead and like and go ahead and jump in there and ask any questions. We'll be sure to respond to you there as well. Just the same as Twitter. We're found in there at moto @_pod. You can follow us there for any news and general motorcycle banter. I can be found on Twitter and Instagram. I am @SkylarV28. Jim, where can people find you?
Twitter and Instagram @MotoRGV.
Woo! Well, Jim, another season done and dusted. A big shout out to you. Thank you this year for all of your contributions. You did a lot of stepping up, especially for our docs this year when I did not have the time, and definitely grabbing the reins on that. So big shout out to you and all the work and time and dedication you put into the show this year. It has been a pleasure, my friend.
It's been a pleasure. I enjoy it. Like I said, got some ideas for some off-season stuff, but we just got underneath a break. So we'll get together, we'll talk, and then we'll talk at you guys.
That's right. So to everyone here in the United States, have a wonderful, happy, and safe Thanksgiving. And if we don't see you, have a wonderful Christmas, New Year. Just general for everyone around the world, have a safe and happy holidays, and we'll see you soon.
Be safe, everyone.
Zoom, zoom.